Well, good afternoon, little children. It is April 3rd, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1630 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green, again, with you for the study of the Crucible article called The C-Cubed, or The Crucible of Credible Creed, Chapter 9, Paragraph 11. This is the table called the Iron Furnace that we finally come to in the study. In fairness or farness to 40 pharaohs, play on words or alliteration, as it's called, alliteration, A-L-L-I-T-E-R-A-T-I-O-N. Now we have the subsumed pharaohs in this table in the color lime green, and Pharaohs aligned by Julian dates in pink, and pharaohs aligned by lunar or Sothic dates in white, and a few other things mentioned in the legend there. The pharaohs are we didn't change many of these dates, we should point out, because Pharaoh Almost the First is in the Crucible 1550 to 1525 in this article, whereas later on we revise it to very late in 1552 or about 1551 for year one of Pharaoh Almost the First. So it doesn't change much, and there's no real issue with his reign being changed in that way. And Pharaoh Amenhotep the First, 1525 to 1504, that doesn't change much either. Pharaoh Thutmose the First, he doesn't change much, or if at all, and neither do Pharaoh Thutmose II or Hatshepsut, who were subsumed by Thutmose III. The only date of his that changes is his last year, 1440. We change it to 1439. And the noteworthy part about this, the point about it that's noteworthy, is, as we mention in the Wild Broad article, which we've already studied, part 1 in chapter 2 here, paragraph 4, just want to confirm that this is in fact the Wild Broad article, is it? Yeah. Wait a minute, hang on. No, it's History of Babylon. Sorry, it's History of Babylon. We haven't studied this article yet. That's right, but it was written prior to, was it? It written prior to the Wild Road? I've got so many things I'm studying. Let me see what this is. Oh yeah, right. Okay. Let me see what these things are. I was just looking at a list. There it is. Here it is. Is it? Is this it? The list of all the articles? Yeah. I think that's what this is, but PDF articles. We can just open that, I guess, and then close it again when we need to. But here. But it's the Ark of Urartu, okay, the Crucible. And then before. Okay. Oh, before was written after the Crucible. Okay. Good. Okay. Yeah, so the very next article after the Crucible article, as we see here, we have the discussion in chapter 2, paragraph 4 of the History of Babylon, part 1. The death, we have the discussion of the death of Thutmose III in 1439. And what we've done is show how Manetho's reign lengths, given here, in the version of Josephus in the middle column here in Fotheringham's History or Chronology of the Old Testament, is what the book is called by Fotheringham. And it says Oros has 36 years, 5 months, and we take that to be death to death. And Thutmose 9 years, 8 months, that's Thutmose the Fourth, we take that as death to death. And 25 years, 10 months, we take as death to death. The 25 years, 10 months being for Amenhotep II after the death of Thutmose III. And then after his death, Thutmose IV for 9 years and 8 months. Then after his death, Amenhotep III for 36 years, 5 months. And that's where that came from. And from that, in this article, The History of Babylon, Part 1, we show how well it all works out here in this paragraph 2, or chapter 2, paragraph 4, I should say. Yeah, paragraph 2 is not right. It's paragraph 4 in chapter 2 of The History of Babylon. It's also called B4, that article. And I say there, look, that the attested year 38 for Amenhotep III agrees with 1405 as his year 1, a date recorded as Apef 13, June 17th. 1405. Right. Seven different publications also. Look at this. From 1969 to 2008, there are seven different publications that agree with our dating of Amenhotep III as ruling 1405 to 1367. And we changed also the date after the Crucible article. We changed the date of Amenhotep IV, or Akhenaten, as he's called. We raised his year 1 to 1375 because we found out that there were 8 years of overlap between his reign and his father's, that is, Amenhotep III's reign. So from the end of the reign of Amenhotep III in 1367, we add 8 years, we get 1375, and that's what we changed Akhenaten's year 1 to. And we do all the lunar alignments again. We do them over again in the later articles. So that's not a problem that we changed it. But the another interesting thing, another very interesting aspect of this table, well, we see a solar eclipse that gives the alignment, importantly. Let's see now. Does it say where that is? Total solar eclipse right there. Yeah. It's to do with the alignment with the Hittite Empire. A total solar eclipse at the Hittite capital city. That's important for aligning with the reign of Ramesses II with his year 1 in 1315. That's how that all works very well. And that's what Peter Huber also said. But when we come down here, finally, we get down to the end of all this, or very near the end of this list here. We come to 1223, and this is very important. This date didn't change at all. Ramesses III, 1223, year 1. That we didn't change that later on. So all of this, all of these dates, and look at it, here's Simon, 1025 to 1009. That didn't change very much as we talk about and discuss, and we've already talked about it quite a bit. And here, Susan II, he didn't change very much at all either. His end date's the same, and the beginning date of Simon's almost the same, 1025. You know, I mean, it's instead of 1024, it's very close. There's no real problem with any of this at all, right? Osirkon on the Elder, yeah. That we did lower down to about 1030 or 1031 from 1033, his year one. So, I mean, this is a very, very useful table. I hope it's very useful. And that's all for today's study of the Crucible article. Now our study of, forgive me for getting ahead of myself. Here it is. Here it is. Where is it? I moved it, I think, somewhere. There it is. Today's proverb from Proverbs chapter 14. Yesterday we did 21 and 22. Today, 23 and 24. Or did we do that yesterday? I'm trying to remember. I can check, I think. 14, 21 and 22, I think, was yesterday. Yeah. No, we did 23 and 24. Okay. That's right. Yeah, we did that. So 25 and 26 for today. Little children. Here we go. Reliable witnesses truly do save, but lying ones blow their hot air to the grave. The fear of Jehovah is strength to endure. His children will hope in a place to be sure. That's the daily reading from the Ward Green version of Proverbs from 2006, chapter 14, verses 24 and 25. I mean 25 and 26. Pardon me. Yeah. 25 and 26 of chapter 14 of Proverbs. And now 2 Chronicles 25. What happened after the death of Jehoash? We learned already that Jehoash ruled from the age of 7 years old. He ruled in our chronology also. We learned when he ruled. We should show that one more time. Where is it? Let's see. I know it's very close by here. Where did I put it? Well, that's a very interesting quote there to do with some of the discussion that we might be getting to later today, hopefully. It's somewhere here. I think it might be this one. Here it is. Yeah, Moses Part 2, the table of the kings of Israel and Judah, and the kings of Judah in table H4. Here we see Jehoash ruled for 40 years from 879 to 839 in the genealogy. Right, so his successor was Amaziah, and he's the one we're reading about now. But in the latter part of the reign of Jehoash, after the death of Jehoiada, Jehoash fell away from the truth. In about the year 947, as we said, was the 130th year after the dividing of the kingdom. And Amaziah ruled for 29 years from 839 to 810 BCE in our chronology. At the age of 25 years, Amaziah became king, and for 29 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jehoaddan of Jerusalem. And he continued to do what was right in Jehovah's eyes, only not with a complete heart. And it came about that as soon as the kingdom had become strong upon him, he promptly killed his servants who had struck down the king his father, and their sons he did not put to death, but did according to what is written in the law in the book of Moses, that Jehovah commanded, saying, fathers should not die for sons, neither should sons themselves die for fathers, but it is each one for his own sin that he should die. I'm looking for the quote from the Law of Moses. Deuteronomy 24 and 16, there it is. Fathers should not be put to death on account of children, and children should not be put to death on account of fathers. Each one should be put to death for his own sin. So it really is in the Law of Moses. In verse 5 of 2 Chronicles 25 now, and Amaziah proceeded to collect Judah together and to have them stand according to the house of the forefathers, by the chiefs of thousands and by the chiefs of hundreds, for all Judah and Benjamin, and he went on to register them from 20 years of age upward, and finally he found them to be 300,000 choice men going out to the army, handling lance and large shield. Further, he hired from Israel 100,000 valiant mighty men for 100 silver talents. Hired them from the northern kingdom. And a certain man of the true God came to him, saying, O king, because the northern kingdom was called Israel, of course. Judah was the southern kingdom. And a certain man of the true God came to him, saying, O king, do not let the army of Israel come with you, for Jehovah is not with Israel. That is all the sons of Ephraim. Ephraim was the northern kingdom. He was the symbol of the northern kingdom. But come you yourself, act, be courageous for the war. The true God, this prophet said to King Amaziah, who reigned 29 years, as we were just saying, the true God, he said, but come you yourself, act, be courageous for the war. The true God could cause you to stumble before an enemy, before there exists power. For there exists power with God. The true God could cause you to stumble before an enemy, for there exists power with God to help and to cause stumbling. At this, Amaziah said to the man of the true God, but what is there to do about the 100 talents that I have given to the troops of Israel? To this the man of the true God said, there exists with Jehovah the means to give you much more than this. That's an example of chasing money, trying to get back money that he's already spent. It's, as the proverb says, you know, anyone who chases money, money sprouts wings for itself and flies away toward the heavens if you're chasing it. And to this the man of the true God said, Jehovah could give you much more. Accordingly, Amaziah separated them, namely the troops that had come to him from Ephraim, to go to their own place. However, their anger got very hot against Judah, so that they returned to their own place in the heat of anger. And Amaziah, for his part, took courage and proceeded to lead his own people and go to the Valley of Salt. And he went striking down the sons of Seir, 10,000 of them. And there were 10,000 that the sons of Judah captured alive. Okay, that the sons of Judah captured alive. Some were captured alive and some were struck down, in other words. Amaziah was leading his people. They were the sons of Judah. And so there were 10,000 that the sons of Judah captured alive, but they also struck 10,000 of the sons of Seir dead. So they brought them to the top of the crag, the captives, that is, and proceeded to throw them from the top of the crag, and they one and all burst apart. As for the members of the troop whom Amaziah had sent back from going with him to the war, they began making raids upon the cities of Judah from Samaria clear to Beth Horon, and went striking down 3,000 of them and taking a great plunder. Now, Samaria is not a city of Judah. It's interesting that it's mentioned there, but they were coming from the northern kingdom, which included Samaria. But it occurred after Amaziah came from striking down the Edomites that he now brought the gods of the sons of Seir and set them up for himself as gods. The very reason he was punishing these Edomites, evidently, was they weren't worshiping Jehovah. Why was he punishing them? Right. He went striking them down. For some reason, he didn't agree with them. But then he brought back they came and struck down 3,000. And took a great plunder. These were the ones that Amaziah had sent away. Right? But when Amaziah came, after Amaziah struck down the Edomites, though, the Edomites were in the south. They were not in the north. They were south of Judah. After he struck them down, he brought the gods of the sons of Seir and set them up for himself as gods. And before them, he began to bow down, and to them, he began to make sacrificial smoke. Consequently, Jehovah's anger became hot against Amaziah. And so he sent a prophet to him and said to him, why have you searched for the people's gods that did not deliver their own people out of your hand? He just had a battle against them and he won the battle. So why would he worship the gods of these people who lost the battle? That was the question from the prophet. And it came about when he spoke to him that the king immediately said to him, was it a counselor of the king that we constituted you? In other words, who's asking you? Quit for your own sake. Why should they strike you down? Accordingly, the prophet quit, but he said, I certainly know that God has resolved to bring you to ruin because you have done this and you have not listened to my counsel. That was what the prophet answered Amaziah. Then Amaziah, the king of Judah, took counsel and sent to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, the king of Israel, this other Jehoash, who was the king of the northern kingdom, at the same time, nearly, as the king of Judah, also called Joash. At one point, their reigns overlapped. And Amaziah said, come, let us look each other in the face. At that, Jehoash, the king of Israel, the northern kingdom, sent to Amaziah, the king of Judah, saying, the thorny weed itself that was in Lebanon sent to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, do give your daughter to my son as a wife. However, a wild beast of the field that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thorny weed down. You have said to yourself, here you have struck down Edom, and your heart has lifted you up to be glorified. Now do keep dwelling in your own house. Why should you engage in strife in a bad position and have to fall, you and Judah with you? In other words, he's warning him, saying, you may not want to tangle with me. You know, just because you beat the Edomites in the battle, you know, you shouldn't be exalting yourself and thinking you're going to beat me, is what he's saying. But Amaziah did not listen, for it was from the true God, for the purpose of giving them into his hand, because they had searched for the gods of Edom. So Jehoash, the king of Israel, went up, and they proceeded to look each other in the face, he and Amaziah, the king of Judah, at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah came to be defeated before Israel, so that they took to flight, each one to his tent. So the northern king defeated Amaziah, and it was Amaziah, the king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, that's another name for Ahaziah, because Ahaz is in the name, and Jeho is the same as Ayah. In other words, it's Jehovah's name. And so Ahaziah is the same as Jehoahaz. So Jehoash was the son of Ahaziah. And it was Amaziah, the king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, that Jehoash, the king of Israel, seized at Beth Shemesh. The northern king seized Amaziah, after which he brought him to Jerusalem and made a breach in the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim clear to the corner gate, 400 cubits. And he took all the gold and the silver and all the articles that were to be found in the house of the true God with Obed-Edom and the treasures of the king's house and the hostages, and then returned to Samaria. And Amaziah, the son of Jehoash, the king of Judah, continued to live after the death of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the king of Israel. And the northern kingdom also had a Jehoash, who was the son of Jehoahaz. Their father's name were the same, too. Father's names. But Amaziah lived after the death of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the king of Israel, 15 years. As for the rest of the affairs of Amaziah, the first and the last, look, are they not written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel? And from the time that Amaziah turned aside from following Jehovah, they proceeded to form a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem. At length he fled to Lachish, but they sent after him to Lachish and put him to death there. So they carried him upon horses and buried him with his forefathers in the city of Judah. Because Amaziah had brought the false gods of Edom after he defeated the Edomites. He took their gods and started to worship these other idol gods, these false gods that had not any meaning to the Israelites in their worship of Jehovah. Jehovah didn't allow them to worship other gods because he's a jealous God. He demands exclusive devotion. So after he became unfaithful like that, he ended up being killed by his own people, by the conspiracy, as it says there in verse 27. And that's the end of the study of 2 Chronicles 25 for today. Habakkuk chapter 1. Clark has some very interesting things to say about this book. He says the prophet enters very abruptly on his subject, his spirit being greatly indignant at the rapid progress of vice and impiety, upon which God is introduced, threatening very awful and sudden judgments to be indicted by the ministry of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, in other words. The Babylonians attribute their wonderful successes to their idols. The prophet, then making a sudden transition, expostulates with God, probably personating the Jews, for permitting a nation much more wicked than themselves, as they supposed, to oppress and devour them as fishers and fowlers do their prey. Then he says, we know little of this prophet, but he's got quite a bit more information that he gives about Habakkuk, probably of the tribe of Simeon, a native of Beth Zekar, and very likely he lived after the destruction of Nineveh, as he speaks of the Chaldeans, but makes no mention of the Assyrians. And there's a wonderful book that he refers to, Louth's Pre-Elect, in the foreword of which there's some very interesting comments right here. On the importance of the subject of the following pages, I trust I need say but little. The principles here discussed are radically connected with the interpretation of the Word of God. The greater part of the Old Testament is poetry, and poetry, too, of a very peculiar and most impassioned kind, and by rules applicable only to poetical language, ought this poetry to be interpreted. Yet many pay very little regard to this important peculiarity. Many pay very little regard to this important peculiarity. They make scarcely any distinction between the poetic and prosaic portions of the Bible, and employ quotations from both as if they had been written with the closest attention to metaphysical precision. And in view of all the subtleties, he spells it differently. In view of all the subtleties of modern philosophy, they employ quotations in such a way. Anyway, that's a fascinating work by, in the preface, that's page 15 of the preface of the book, by the Mr. Louth mentioned by Adam Clark in his commentary. Robert Louth wrote this particular book, 1829 is the date. Habakkuk, the pronouncement that Habakkuk the prophet visioned. How long, O Jehovah, must I cry for help, and you do not hear? How long shall I call to you for aid from violence, and you do not save? Why is it that you make me see what is hurtful, and you keep looking upon mere trouble? And why are despoiling and violence in front of me? And why does quarreling occur, and why is strife carried? Therefore law grows numb, and justice never goes forth, because the wicked one is surrounding the righteous one. For that reason, justice goes forth crooked. See, you people among the nations, and look on and stare in amazement at one another. Be amazed, for there is an activity that one is carrying on in your days, which you people will not believe, although it is related. For here I am raising up the Chaldeans, the nation bitter and impetuous, which is going to the wide open places of earth in order to take possession of residences not belonging to it. We know when the Babylonians came and conquered Jerusalem and Judah, they took captives. Frightful and fear-inspiring it is. From itself its own justice and its own dignity go forth, and its horses have proved swifter than leopards. But this hadn't happened yet, of course. This is a prophecy. And its horses have proved swifter than leopards, and they have proved fiercer than evening wolves. That part had already been proved true, of course, but their capture of Judah had not yet occurred. And its steeds have pawed the ground, and from far away its own steeds come. They fly like the eagle, speeding to eat something. In its entirety it comes for mere violence. The assembling of their faces is as the east wind, and it gathers up captives, just like the sand. And for its part it jeers kings themselves, and high officials are something laughable to it. For its part it laughs even at every fortified place, and it piles up dust and captures it. At that time it will certainly move onward like wind, and will pass through, and will actually become guilty. This, its power, is due to its God. The Babylonians had a strong belief in their own God. Are you not from long ago, O Jehovah, O my God, my Holy One? You do not die, O Jehovah, for a judgment you have set it. And O rock, forever proving, you have founded it. You are too pure in eyes to see what is bad, to look on trouble you are not able. Why is it that you look on those dealing treacherously, that you keep silent when someone wicked swallows up someone more righteous than he is? Right. And why do you make earthling man like the fishes of the sea, like creeping things over whom no one is ruling? All these he has brought up with a mere fish hook. He drags them away in his dragnet, and he gathers them in his fishing net. That is why he rejoices and is joyful. That is why he offers sacrifice to his dragnet and makes sacrificial smoke to his fishing net. For by them his portion is well oiled, and his food is healthful. It's like fish oil. It makes me think of fish oil, which is a very, very useful supplement. Is that why he will empty out his dragnet, and does he have to kill nations constantly while he shows no compassion? Fish are oily, or there are oily fish, at least, and that's part of the component of why what makes them... That's the one of the components of the fish, right? It's one of the reasons why they're healthy as food. So does Jehovah have to kill nations constantly, or the fishermen, while he shows no compassion? That's the question asked at the end there. That's the end of Habakkuk chapter 1. For a judgment you have set it. There's a reference here. This is Habakkuk, a reference to Habakkuk 1 and 12. Habakkuk understood that Jehovah would use Babylon. See, he set Babylon to make the judgment, to do the judging of Israel by coming and capturing Israel. That's what that's talking about. And the Watchtower, November 2018, paragraph 9 of the article Trust in Jehovah and Live says, Habakkuk understood that Jehovah would use Babylon to judge and punish the evildoers surrounding him, that is, surrounding Habakkuk, but he was still perplexed. Yet he humbly told Jehovah that he continued to be his rock. That's the end of our study for April 3rd, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 17:03 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.